Breaking the Panel is made possible by you and other listeners just as awesome as you are. If you want to support the show and get a little something in return, just go to patreon.com/breakingthepanel, because we do appreciate the help.
I actually just got a text from Charles. He wants me to announce that next week, Chris, Charles, and Paul will not be on the panel. We will have Joe, Travis, and Dennis. So enjoy that show next week, everybody.
These days, the comic book owns pop culture. You'll find it all in the panel of your favorite comic book. Us, we're living the comic's life. We're breaking the panel.
Hello, and welcome to Breaking the Panel. My name is Paul Klotz, and I don't have anybody helping me today. I mean, I have two great guests, none other than Audrey Kearns from Booze and Phasers. Say hello.
Hi there.
And some crap bird from Botched. Say hi, Phil.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me today, guys. So we have a little bit of a weird show today because we don't have Chris Wisdom, who's still, you know, off doing secret government work. I mean, it's probably not that secret, but so he won't be back for a few more weeks. And Charles is out today because he's a big dumb loser. And we're super stoked about that. So we're going to do it my way.
Congratulations on draining the swamp of breaking the panel, Paul.
Oh, thank you, Phil. Yeah, you know, it was one of my campaign promises, and I like to follow through.
I'm very excited.
But yeah, we're gonna talk about some really interesting developments this week. In particular, some kind of meta things. We've kind of touched a little bit on the writer's strike in the past. We'll get to that in just a moment. But the first thing that hit my radar this week is I wanted to bring up there was some booing at Cannes this weekend.
Yes, there was.
So basically, Audrey, do you want to kind of paraphrase what happened? Because you might be a little more connected to this than I am.
Well, from what I understand, they had their premiere and of Okja, which I'm really looking forward to seeing, and they were booed, and press and people covering it are now saying that it's not so much that they didn't like the movie, because the movie actually got really great reviews. I mean, we've been covering the movie for Geek Girl Authority, and it's been getting really great reviews. The trailers look great, but it's more of it's a streaming service. And I think a lot of con people are purists, and they look down upon that. To them, that's like low class. And I guess they used to have certain rules at Cannes Film Festival where they don't want it to be available to the consumer at home for, I think, like 2 or 3 years. Whereas Netflix, they'll put it out in a theater if they can get theaters to carry it and release it online at the same time. And they think that that lessens the quality of cinema and the quality of what the festival is all about. And that's really the reason that they were booing. But if that's true, then why did they even go to the premiere in the first place? If they just to boo? I don't know.
Yeah, and so that's really this article, which will be in the show notes. I pulled this from Inverse.com, written by Jordan Zacharin. And they kind of talk about this. They analyze the whole situation, and their headline is, "Netflix isn't killing movies, Hollywood studios and theaters are." This really stood out to me. Because one of the great points that he or she, I actually don't know if it's a male or female, I apologize. I don't want to presume anything. This person had a really interesting perspective in that they pointed out that, you know, a lot of the, what we would consider indie or art films aren't actually available to the general public in most places. You know, one of the things that stood out to me was that because they're usually very limited run, so they're usually only in major metro areas and a few cultural hubs, at least over here in North America, you know, scattered about. It might not be so hard to get yourself to a really good art house theater in Europe, for example. But over here, it can be, you know, there's millions of people that don't live anywhere near a theater that would show these kind of films. And in particular, because of the, you know, changes in the industry and everything, they don't, you know, a lot of the theaters that might have shown it 10, 15, 20 years ago don't exist anymore because the nature of the business has changed and it's swallowed up a lot of these smaller mom and pop places. So I guess I kind of wanted to hear what you guys thought about this whole thing, because the big thing here is that Cannes announced that they're looking to ban any entries from streaming services. So that would be your Netflix, your Amazon, your Hulu, you know, potentially Hulu, anything like that. And, you know, I find that really interesting, but I'll let you guys kind of give me your take on it.
Cool. Phil, you want to go first?
Yeah, no, it just, no, I'll go first. It just, it seems like a fear of change, pretty much. The viewing market has drastically changed in the last even 5 to 10 years. And I certainly, personally, I would, having a small kid, getting to the theater is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So I rely on these streaming services to bring not only IndiePlex but bigger titles to me that I had to wait, you know, the 6 to 9 months to get. So to me, it's just, it's a little frustrating because I enjoy Cannes. I always look for, you know, Cannes selected films, and it breaks my heart a little bit for them to stick their nose up to quality, you know, quality.
Yeah. And I think that's actually going to end up biting them in the butt. Actually, because I understand that they're purists and everything. I think you hit the nail on the head, in my opinion, Phil, is I do think it's a fear of change and wanting to keep things as they always were. And in this article, you know, they spoke with that one filmmaker where he's like, you know, the hypnosis of the big screen, and we want to keep that. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. I get what it's like to be in a theater and be completely enthralled and entranced in a film. But as you were saying, it's not easy for people to get to the theater. And also, honestly, a lot of people have big screens in their homes now. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. And another thing is art. And the more art that we can get out there, I mean, look at the way cable television is right now and all the quality entertainment and writing and production that's out there. If Netflix has the money to do it, where I can see a really interesting, I mean, I love Snowpiercer, which is the same director that's doing Okja. So I'm very excited about seeing this movie. But I can't see those kinds of movies. I mean, even here in Los Angeles, where I can see pretty much anything I want because everything's going to come to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The theaters that you can possibly afford are all the big, big popcorn movies. Even if they're great movies, you're still just getting the same thing all the time. So I'm all for streaming services, trying new things and giving us, and I think it's a shame that Cannes is not including it. I get where they're coming from. I get, like, I'm a theater snob as far as going to see theater and stuff like that. But I also understand that, you know, change is good. Change is what brings us forward when it comes to art. And it's a shame that they're being snobs about it. And especially because if you search Cannes right now on Google, you know what's going to come up? The Kardashians, because evidently that's a place to go to now. So it's all about the party scene. That's the same thing that's happened with Sundance.
Yeah, I was just about to say Sundance came that way too.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's just, I mean, yeah, the Palme d'Or still means a lot, and I wish that all good art could be in the running to get that award. That's what I think.
Yeah, you know, to kind of circle back around to it a little bit here, I know that there's a number of smaller films that I would never have gotten an opportunity to see if not for streaming services. Snowpiercer is a great example. I would never have seen that film if it wasn't on Netflix. Now, it didn't originate on Netflix, but I mean, streaming services put that into my home and put it at my fingertips.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I didn't watch it on Netflix, but it was released the same day as it was in theaters, and we were home that night. I was sick. We got it on iTunes or wherever they were selling it, renting it. And we, you know, it was great because we watched it twice in 24 hours, but it was a great experience. I was completely enthralled with that, and it didn't take anything away because I was sitting on my couch.
See, and that's where I'm getting most of my documentaries these days. It's from Netflix or Amazon that, you know, I can't get in Central Pennsylvania Regal cinemas. So,
yeah.
Like the Amy, I would never have gotten to see Amy if it wasn't for Amazon Prime.
Right. That's a really good point.
And,
go ahead, Phil.
No, also Ex Machina I saw that on Amazon. It was the only way I could see it without driving 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. You know, maybe the people that run Cannes, maybe they're not I don't believe them if they say that we're not interested in ticket sales, we're interested in the art and the experience and blah 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 blah.
What
But
they need to do is
I
start a
think
streaming service.
there you go.
every year that any films that go to Cannes, I'm allowed to stream for $24 that year.
I
I'd
love
pay
it.
Into that.
Well, you know, and the thing is too, like, there's a big problem, obviously. Anybody who pays attention to the industry in Hollywood right now knows that there's a big issue with production companies' willingness to adopt projects that aren't like huge IPs, that aren't, you know, something that's basically guaranteed to generate profit. You know, anything that's like attached to an existing IP that people, you know, have a fan base of, or, you know, anything like that. So it's very hard to get a traditional production company to support an indie film or a art film these days, because the market is just really volatile. I mean, some of them work out, but many of them don't, you know. And I'm reminded of, I had to look it up real quick here, Beasts of No Nation, that Netflix put out last year, which was about, you know, African child soldiers. And it's a great film. It's really powerful. It's, you know, it's right up there for me with a number of other smaller films, art films that I've seen over the years. You know what I mean? Like, where I was like, wow, this had a really interesting story. It's, you know, not something I could have expected to see in a big typical theater with a bunch of people. It's something I would have expected to have to go to like a college or something and see in a tiny little, you know, college theater or something like that. You know, Netflix made that happen. You know what I mean?
They did. And I was at last fall, I was at Netflix here in Los Angeles for a meeting, and they brought up that movie, and they really had to work hard to get it even considered for awards season, for many of the same reasons that the Cannes Film Festival is maybe going to ban streaming services. It has to run in a theater, and it has to run for so long. So even though they were releasing it on the streaming services, they still had to get, if I remember correctly, like theaters in New York or whatever to run it. And so that they can say it was in a movie theater to be considered for certain movie awards and everything. And look, it ended up winning some awards too. Yeah. So it's not about quality. And the thing about Netflix, at least right now, is they have money to throw at these projects, especially like what you were talking about, Paul, you know, stuff that wouldn't be necessarily bought by a big studio because they're not going to get the returns that they want. Netflix, you know, they're very secretive with their numbers as far as like releasing how many people watch movies or television shows. And I'm not saying that's right or not, but in doing so, it makes it easier for them to throw money towards different projects.
Mm-hmm. And they also take chances.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
They, you know, they probably shouldn't have greenlit Arrested Development season 4, but they gave it a chance. That's something that bigger production companies are going to look at and just say, "No, no way in hell we're going to give you money for this." So you know, I'm a little frustrated with the whole situation.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, because I just last night finished Master of None season 2, and that's a show that I don't know that could have ended up on a regular network. You know, it certainly wouldn't have ended up on network TV, you know, like non-cable. And then even with the cable production companies, I'm not sure how many of them would have gotten behind a project like that, especially because the second season kind of came out a little bit staggered from the first season. Like, it wasn't a smooth transition like your typical, oh, here's your fall show kind of thing. And I'm also reminded of Hulu's Casual, another show that I really enjoy. These shows are not, they don't fit your traditional structure, and I find them immensely entertaining because I think they're really great, like, existential looks at, you know, modern life of, you know, people of today, you know, what we go through generationally and everything. I think they're really good snapshots, and they're really entertaining. They're funny too. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're fantastically funny in their moments, but they're also like really bittersweet, and that's art. That it's right there. Yeah. You know, that is art in a nutshell.
Amazon TV recently, I found something on there called Fleabag, which is just a 6-episode comedy written by this woman in England that would have never made it to any kind of screen here. And it's very, it's like a slice of life, like you were saying, but it's very funny. I could tell it was a one-person play at one point. you just needed those six episodes and this look at this woman's life, and it was fantastic. And then, you know, Hulu's Handmaid's Tale right now. I mean, talk about existential threats. You know, that is a fantastic show. And yeah, I think they put a lot of money into that one, obviously. But I mean, I can't see anyone taking a chance on that outside of Hulu or a streaming service or HBO or one of the premium channels and everything. So thank God for streaming. That's what I say.
Yeah, I think most of the television I watch is actually on streaming now that I think about it. Like Transparent, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, One Mississippi, like all these shows that I hold so dear are all on streaming services.
Yeah. But I think Netflix is having an uphill battle in their original movies world. I mean, their TV is going to do fine. All their episodes are going to do fine. But I don't know how this will affect them. It will, as far as prestige is concerned. You know, I know they're really working hard to get more people watching their original films. And even in the article that you sent out, Paul, it talks about the theater going experience. I mean, with ticket prices climbing and stuff, yeah, a lot of us are turning to streaming, but it's still hard for Netflix and other streaming service to get a lot of the public their heads wrapped around watching a big budget movie. Like, I'm curious what's going to happen when Netflix's Bright comes out with Will Smith, you know, if that's going to do really well, because I don't know if they're going to bring that to theaters. That might just be on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if Will Smith can't carry a movie, then no one can, you know? Right. So that'll be really interesting. And it's a sci-fi movie. And we'll see what happens with that.
So I've got a little blurb here from Chris Wisdom, who I hit with the same article that I hit you guys with, because I really wanted his take on it, even though he's away. And he got it into me at the 11th hour. So I'm going to read it for you guys real quick. And we can kind of move on after that. But Chris says, pretty sure you and I are on the same page on this. The studios are doing it to themselves and to the theaters. When the studios care more about the money they, quote-unquote, should see from an IP rather than the actual adaptation or the money draw for names attached rather than who fits best with the project, they set themselves and audiences up for failure. The theaters make money where they can, but they have to reel in those concession prices. The ones with booze and actual food see a 15 to 20% markup versus bars and restaurants, and I'm okay with that. 500% markup on candy and 3,000% markup on popcorn and soft drinks is going to plaid. Exhibitors need to get on the same page to put. He also put in, I called it soft drinks because he tried to slip pop in, and I'm not about that. So there's none of that here, Chris. I know you're going to listen to this right away, too. Exhibitors need to get on the same page to push back against the studios and their exorbitant demands. Not sure what the answer is. Both the studios and the theaters are in the Gordon Gekko mode, and it's hard to convince them that all, quote-unquote, the money is not in things they can never get. Studios don't really care about the audience, just the money. Theaters, at least, have to deal in customer service. Hollywood and the studio establishment need to get on board with and embrace new media and delivery systems before they're left behind. Indies need a venue and shouldn't be penalized for finding a way to share their art. And I agree with what Chris says there. A little disjointed because he sent it to me as via Facebook, so I apologize. Anybody want to tell Chris he's wrong? Because that would be fantastic.
Well, Chris and I are in the beginning of our friendship, so I'm hesitant to say mean things yet. I'm sure we'll get to that place.
The surest way to solidify your friendship with Chris is to be mean to him.
Okay, I'm going to send him at least 10 very awkward memes tonight that will offend him. That's what I'll do.
Good luck.
Get ready, Chris. I agree with Chris. I also think that nothing is going to change until the studio is hurt. And I think we're a while away from them being hurt because they're still riding the wave of these big tentpole movies and universes and stuff like that. And when they start getting hurt, then maybe they'll change. I mean, because he's absolutely right. It's money driven. I think fans and, you know, all of us are very hardcore fans in our own fandoms. And we know from experience that we can scream till we're blue in the face. But if they're not going to care if it doesn't affect, you know, if it affects their bottom line. Right. And everything. So until it's the same thing with the big four networks on TV, you know, the last couple of years have been very interesting because they've stopped winning awards. They've stopped being nominated. You know, it's all cable and streaming now that's getting nominated. So are they going to start changing? They might start changing the way they do TV now. And I think it's the same thing that's going to happen to movies. And you know what? As far as the theaters, tickets are getting way out of control. I mean, I hate to say back in my day, but I will say back in my day, my husband and I could go to a movie that, you know, and get everything for $25, you know, tickets, popcorn and everything. And
Oh,
now,
yeah.
I mean, granted, I'm in Los Angeles now. Now you're talking about like, you know, $40 just for the ticket.
Oh, man.
And that's not even talking about like concessions and stuff. And now out here now, a couple of the theaters are starting to sell booze at the concession stand that you can take in with you. You know, so they're making their money on that, but it's an expensive night out. And Phil was talking about children. Can you imagine having to take, if you have a family of five and you try, I mean, that's $100 in tickets right there.
Oh, yeah.
You, of course you want to watch it on your TV at home, you know?
Charles talks about it on the show all the time. They have, I believe they have four children. I think it's four. So he and his wife are always looking for opportunities to keep the costs down. They look for like
Right.
promotions with free tickets and all that. And it's still something that they can only take the whole family to every once in a while. It's just unreasonable. And that obviously hurts sales. I'm 33 years old. I grew up in the 90s. I remember probably what we would consider the peak of the movie going time, like when everybody. Adults looked at movies as a cheap date. Kids looked at, movies as a cheap afternoon. You know what I mean? Like, I used to be able to get a 20 from my parents, go to the mall, we'd see a movie, we'd get lunch, and I'd still have enough money to buy something stupid or go to the arcade or, any of those kind of things, So it's a completely different world as far as cost is concerned. And it's, and the technology is in our homes. So I really do feel like if the industry doesn't adapt and accept the reality of the changing world around them, very much like the music industry, they're going to get left holding the bag. And
Absolutely. And with home entertainment systems, with the prices coming down all the time, like I said earlier, you can get a nice size TV. And if it's not even a giant TV, the quality on the TV is going to be great. And you can get a nice sound system. And that could be your, you know, make your family happy for years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you have a family of, like four or five or something like that, it doesn't take long to do the cost benefit analysis between going to the movies a couple of times or just buying a nice television and watching them at home, you know. Okay, so our next topic this week is really lucky for a number of reasons. One, it's about the WGA strike, and we're really lucky to have Audrey with us because she's going to be able to speak from a place of authority on this, and it's not going to be just three knuckleheads, talking about nonsense like it normally is. So yeah, Audrey, I'm just going to toss it to you here and just let you kind of run with this and let us know kind of where we're at with everything.
Cool. I wanted to make some a couple of big points on the Writers Guild. First of all, I'd like everyone to know these are my opinions and my husband's opinions. I am not in the Writers Guild. My husband is in the Writers Guild. He's a television writer, and he's been in the Writers Guild for the last possibly 7 or 8 years, and it's changed our lives as far as healthcare, making rent, and all that. And I think the big thing for people to know, which the studios try to spin this, that the majority of writers are middle class journeymen. You know, there are some very rich creators out there, but most writers are middle class and just going from job to job to job, trying to have that career and support their families. In the last 10 years of peak TV, the studios have seen billions and billions in profit, the highest in history, actually. And writers' salaries have trended downwards, basically making it either you're a rich writer or it's making the middle class writer disappear, you know? And the writers were asking for 1%, just 1% of their everyone back to a middle class financial situation by asking for increases in healthcare residuals and minimums. And they got most of those. The agreement is for the next 3 years. The first thing is, do you mind if I go over what they got in the contract?
Sure, yeah,
Yeah, I would
absolutely.
love it.
Okay, so the first thing is minimums, okay? They got a, I believe, like, was it a 0.5%? I don't know. They got an increase in minimums. And what this means is increase in the minimum script fees and episodic fees for writers on pay cable and streaming. Most of this strike dealt with television writers. For years, there's been a two-tier system There's been cable and streaming and network for scripts and episodes, even though the work is exactly the same. When these minimums were set in the early days of cable, it made sense. And cable shows made less profit, and paying union writers network minimums would have made the production too pricey. So in order to make cable shows union, the union just made it cheaper for them to use writers, WGA writers. But in today's world, in 2017, where Walking Dead is huge and The Americans and Fargo and all this awesome cable television, the highest rated shows on television just no longer makes sense. And so the outcome of that, it gives them a long overdue increase in minimums, which I think was well deserved. Another thing that was pretty big that really affects writers is how long the span of work is, what they call it. This is probably one of the biggest ones that they negotiated. This sets a new limit on how many weeks of work can be considered an episode. So most writers are paid by the episode and their salary is spread over the entire season. So say you're making $2,500 an episode and you're working on 10 episodes, but the 10 episodes take 20 weeks to film. Okay. With cable and streaming shows, it was harder because of the smaller orders. There's 10 or maybe 8 episodes, and this salary is spread out over a much longer time, and it's driven down writers' overall salaries. So now they can only take 2.4 weeks per episode. It can't be any more than that. And if it spreads out longer, then the studios have to compensate. Okay, so that was a really big one. Another big one was health plan contributions. WGA, I have to say, that union really takes care of their people when it comes to healthcare. It's one of the best healthcare plans I've ever been involved in. And they fought very hard for it over the years. So what this does, with changes in the healthcare law, people living longer and smaller amounts of contributions to do shorter seasons, et cetera, the plan has been stressed the past few years without greater contributions from the employers who, like I said, have seen huge profits over the biggest in history over the last 10 years. The plan would be more insolvent in 3 to 5 years. So this saves the plan for many years to come. I don't know if I made that make sense, but it's good. And this is another one, is when you're on a show and you're waiting to hear if the show's picked up or not for another season, you can't go get a job on another show. So you're exclusive to that show. So when the show ends its season and you're waiting to see if it gets picked up, the writers, it's against the rules to go on another show, so that there can be the reason is continuity with the writing staff, which makes sense. But with shorter seasons and longer periods in time in between new seasons now, sometimes it's over a year. I mean, you look at Westworld, they ended their season and it's a year and a half before their next season is going to air. So some writers are being held for long periods of time, keeping them from getting other work or getting pay. So now the whole time is limited. There's a limit on that. And this one I find as a woman, very interesting, is that you didn't get any paid child leave, and it's still, and you could be fired, you could lose your job, but now you will still get unpaid parental leave. It's still unpaid, but it is leave if you have a baby or decide to adopt. So this was a great threat, especially to female writers who have it harder in the business anyway. And this one is a big win for fairness and helping to bring the industry into the modern world. They also did one on residuals and increases residual payments for all kinds of non-network writing. So think of pay TV comedy shows like Bill Maher or Last Week Tonight. Those writers will finally, for the first time, get residuals on their work. Residuals are very important because of, like I'm saying, those hold times when you're not allowed to work, or because your show is, you know, stretched out over a long part of the year, you really count on your residuals for those hard times. So I think those are the main things that writers were able to get from the strike. And I hope this illustrates that, you know, because the studios do such a good job making it sound like it's a bunch of rich writers that just want more money. This really had to do with healthcare, quality of life, and just being able to, you know, pay your mortgage and be treated fairly.
Yeah. So, you know, we're not a show that we try to avoid politics for the most part, but I think I just kind of want to, from a layman's perspective, just say that what all of this sounded like is, you know, the guild was lobbying for the things that just anybody would expect from their place of employment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of people don't know.
I had no idea about the maternity leave. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
That's absolutely insane to me.
Yeah.
So I'm glad they were able to negotiate that out to be like normal humans.
Yeah.
Exactly. And hopefully next time that they do a negotiation, they can make it paid parental leave.
Yeah,
you know,
hopefully.
I think they had to make some sacrifices this time, and the fact that they just were able to get it where you weren't going to lose your job was a big win.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people look at entertainment, and obviously everybody knows that there's a lot of money in the industry and all that kind of stuff. And you look at, like, you know, the compensation that, say, a big name actor gets or anything like that, and you assume maybe casually that, you know, all the writers and everybody else who works on films and TV shows and all that kind of sort of thing, that they all get crazy salary as well. But it's just not the case, you know.
Yeah.
I really liked when you highlighted, you know, what they were trying to secure was a middle class living.
Yes.
You know, like a working class, middle class living. And I think that's respectable. I mean, also something to consider is if you want to work in the industry, you have to live in a, you know, a relatively small amount of places generally, you know, if you want to be able to find frequent work. And those places tend to have higher cost of living as well.
Yep.
And, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's actually a really, really good point. You know, when you hear that, like, say when SAG was on strike a while ago, it's the same thing. It's not the rich actors, the A-list actors going on strike. It's people like I'm in the union, like me, going on strike to get better health benefits. And so, you know, there was a strike with voiceover actors in gaming a little while ago.
Yeah, or a couple there months was ago.
Yeah, and so a lot of my friends do a lot of that work, and one of the articles coming out, this guy for the LA Weekly wrote the most tone-deaf article I've ever read, saying that it was actually kind of awesome. It was almost like a storm happened in LA where I'm surprised that guy didn't lose his job. he found out that a day rate for a VO actor is like close to $800. It's $700 or $800. And yes, when you hear that, that sounds great. But guess what? Voiceover actors don't get work, you know, 5 days a week for 52 weeks of the year. It's high for a reason because of the quality and the product that you are giving. You know, not anybody can be a VO actor or an actor or a writer. You have to be talented and really work on your craft. But also, you're not guaranteed to get work the whole year. You know, you can get 5 gigs for an entire year. And then you're constant. Most voiceover actors are working 3 or 4 jobs at the same time, in addition to going into a booth and recording for one of the biggest games on the planet. So I think it's very important for, like Paul, I'm glad you had noticed that, to understand that most of these people in this industry are journeymen. You know, they are people that are working at a craft for their entire careers, whether or not they end up on the cover of Vanity Fair or not. That's, you know, what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big gamer. I play lots of video games. I've played a number of video games with extensive voice work. And I've watched some documentaries and some behind the scenes stuff, and I've seen the amount of work that goes into it. So when that strike was coming up, I was like, yeah, no, that makes sense. Cause you know, we know that voice actor, anybody who's done a little bit of research, you'll find out that voice actors do dozens of takes sometimes of different things. They do it a billion different ways, just like actors are expected to do. But like, you've got to, you know, there was a great documentary that the name of it slips my mind. But there was a great documentary a few years ago where they really went into that, and they're like, you know, the best voice actors they work a lot, but that's because they're the best of the best, and they can do tons of different voices, and they can do them all day, basically.
Are you talking about Who's That Voice?
I think so, yeah. I think that was, which was fantastic.
Or I Know That Voice?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, that was great.
That was the... But one of the things that I've heard about video games in particular is that because you've got to do a lot of the, like, you know, the background type stuff, so you got to do, like, the grunting.
It's the actual grunt work.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the,
literally.
Literally the grunt work.
All the weird little filler, you know, what you would consider filler sounds and noises and stuff that doesn't stand out to you necessarily when you play a video game because it's what we do as people. It's just things we do every day. But all of those things have to be recorded. And generally, you want them to be recorded by the person who's voicing the character as well, because otherwise it just sounds weird. So it's a lot of work. And I know, like, many voice actors who work on video games in particular have talked about how those jobs really push them to their limits. It pushes their health.
Yeah, absolutely. If you just say, I am a good actor, I'm not a good voice actor. It's just a talent I don't have. But you're absolutely right. I was talking to a friend of mine, his friend, especially with women, having to scream for voiceovers and gaming and stuff like that, people have had to leave that part of the industry because of stressed vocal cords. You can do it with all that grunting and all the sounds. It can do a lot of, and that's their product. That's what they're selling. That's what their career is. And my friend Josh Dean, I interviewed him for one of my episodes of Neil Before Odd. He voice directed Mass Effect Andromeda. And he was talking about, you know, he got, can't remember the exact number, but basically he had like 100,000 lines. I mean, there's more than one director on it. So he had to basically, you know, get with these actors and they had to do 100,000 lines, you know, one after the other, different takes. And a lot of that includes the, you know, as in gaming, like a lot of people are screaming, you know, and it's not easy. And these people deserve the money that they're making for it.
Yeah, that just sounds...
It's intense.
100,000 recording sounds in.
Yeah, and that was just his job because there was more than, I think there was more than one. I'm not sure if I'm correct. More than one voice director for Mass Effect Andromeda, but yeah, that's a lot.
It's a lot of work on something that gets strained so easily. And, you know, you just you push yourself too hard at one point, and your voice goes, and then you're out. You're out for who knows how long. So it's hard work, and I'm happy that they're finally get the dues that they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Me too.
I think it's just, you know, ultimately, to kind of sum up this topic, I think it's really important that the public, you know, if you're a fan of films and TV and all that kind of stuff, you know, as much as you might be a fan of an artist who draws or paints or, you know, somebody who animates or any of that kind of stuff, you have to acknowledge that these people work very hard to bring your entertainment to you and to do the best job that they can. And, you know, it's impossible for people to do that if they can't make a living wage. And it's a very hectic business and, you know, work isn't necessarily traditionally steady. So, you know, they have to be fairly compensated. And I think that's really important to be mindful of. And I'm really glad that they were able to come to an agreement that works, that they were able to avoid the strike. Cause I mean, you know, a lot of us who were around, you know, 10 years ago when that strike went through, that was devastating to a lot of great television. You know, Heroes gets
mentioned. That was really devastating. Yeah, Heroes. And there was a few, I mean, my husband lost his job. I mean, we were on the lines picketing and everything in front of we did most of our picketing in front of Sony. But he was on a show that year, and we had a really, it was for the right reasons. It's just a lot of, not only, we lost a lot of great art, but people lost a lot of jobs too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's right. I can only imagine.
And this one went to, I mean, they had to, this one was crazy because I don't know if you guys were watching it like my husband was, because this really affected how the rest of our year was going to work out. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 11:30 and he's like, you know, they're sending out messages to everybody in the guild about what's happening. And cause it's supposed to end at 12 and they're still in there negotiating. And then they sent out a message that it was being extended for, I forget, it was like half an hour, 45 minutes. It's been extended. So we're waiting up after midnight, just constantly refreshing. I had a friend of mine who works on the Flash, actually, was down at headquarters where they were making picket signs. They made like 1,000 picket signs in case it didn't go through so everybody could be ready to strike the next day. So it was like 1 o'clock before everyone found out, oh God, we're not striking, thank God.
I would have gone through every bottle of wine in my house.
we went through, we may have done some drinking, Phil. We may have done some drinking. I mean, everybody was kind of positive about it because when they did the vote for authorization, it was like a 90-something percent authorization. That meant 90-something percent of the guild members voted for the strike, which made the studios realize, oh, they're not kidding around.
Hell,
we have to get in there and negotiate. If it was like 70 or 80%, then I think they would have been, it would have been a harder negotiation.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's a testament to the power of negotiation and compromise, hopefully the next time negotiations come up, you guys get to, those who are members of the guild get to fight for a little bit more.
Like I said, the big thing was that, you know, a lot was, we got a lot and residuals, minimums, healthcare. So, but like you said, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of give and take, so they didn't get everything they wanted, but it was enough not to go on strike.
All right.
Congrats.
Thanks for giving me a soapbox to talk about it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. You can borrow my soapbox anytime you want.
Excellent.
You know, I've got a really fancy one. It's got my name stenciled on it and everything.
Nice.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to take a moment to let you hear some words from our sponsor, and we'll be right back. All right. Welcome back. And I said it was really, really lucky that we had Audrey today for a couple of our prior topics, but it is...
Sorry, Phil. It's all about me.
Oh, it's all right. You're about to get real angry at me real quick, so...
Oh, come on! Yeah. You've got to be kidding.
No, we'll see.
All right, okay. All right.
So, of course, Audrey's, you know, one of the hosts of Booze and Phasers, which is a wonderful show that explores everything Star Trek, and we got hit this past week with two very relevant trailers. The first was the trailer for The Orville, which is the new... Seth MacFarlane. I almost said Seth Green. That would be good, too. But it would be a way different
trailer. I'm sure he's in there somewhere.
The new Seth MacFarlane Star Trek spoof, which is going to hit screens very soon comparatively to Star Trek Discovery, which also had its trailer come out. So have both of you had a chance to see both trailers so far?
I have.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what we're going to talk about today is what were your guys' takes on... we'll start with Star Trek Discovery, and then we'll jump to the spoof afterwards. I'd love to hear, Audrey, you know, we'll let you kick it off, and then we'll ask Phil, and we'll go from there.
Well, we already know that Phil doesn't like the trailer, but okay.
It's not cemented in stone yet. We'll see.
I loved it. I was so excited. Just because, you know, we've been covering all the crap that's been happening with Star Trek Discovery, and this may be some of it, is that we saw this trailer, and I actually was watching it with my husband, and I'm like, he's a huge Star Trek fan, but I am obviously the one that's like super connected to it. And so we're watching it, and I thought I was really excited. And I turned to my husband, and he's crying. And can I say a bad word, Paul, on this podcast?
Yeah, it's okay.
So he has tears in his eyes, and I'm like, holy crap, he got emotional about this. And I looked at him, and he just looked at the TV because I'm just so glad it doesn't look like shit, you know? So that's why he cried. He loves Star Trek so much. He was just, you know, with all the trouble they've been having, that it didn't look like crap. But I'm really intrigued by a lot of the hints that they dropped that we didn't know about, because we don't know much about the story. I'm really intrigued by Burnham's, you know, connection to Vulcan. You know, they dropped a lot of hints about her and her character. I mean, she has this line straight out of the gate where, we have no map and you can't set a course without a star, you know, which I get. You know, I have diagnosed OCD. I need a reason to do everything. And that's why I always connect with Vulcan logic.
Yeah.
You know, so So she says that, and I was like, I love that. That sets up a whole bunch of character conflict if she's going to become a Starship commander or whatever they're going to do with the character. And then they show all the stuff with Sarek. So was she raised on Vulcan? What's that about? And then she goes in the trailer, she goes from, you need a star to set a course to cut off its head and we have to fire first, mm-hmm. So I think she's going to have this kind of internal battle between the way she was raised and what she's going through. And I thought that was really cool. I loved the special effects. I loved the ship coming through the clouds. I don't know if that's the Shenzhou, which is Michelle Yeoh's ship, or if that was Discovery. I'm not sure. I love James Frayn as Sarek, Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it didn't seem like there was a lot of details just yet. It was mostly just to give us an overall impression.
Yeah, and who knows if it's all going to turn out to be a good story. I'm fine with the Klingons looking different. There's so much lore to Klingons, and if there was a pandemic that made them different, but there's a lot of lore on, it's been alluded to that there was a different kind of Klingon. I love that it looks like they're having a funeral in that clip, and it just made me excited. I don't know much about the story. I liked the aliens. I liked it all. Bill, what did you think?
I think it looked fun, and I am pretty happy to see where it's at with so many delays. It looks very polished for being pushed back so much. I am just not a Star Trek person. So
okay. That's fine. That's acceptable.
I have never seen a Star Trek movie, and I have only watched about 25 episodes split between TOS and TNG. So...
Okay.
Will I?
So you're not having that emotional reaction like I have.
No, no. But I mean, I'm not down on Star Trek. I just was never. I was never raised on the Trek. I was raised on the Wars. So,
yeah.
As a young kid, you weren't allowed to cross those lines. But
yes,
I think it looks great. With as many delays as they had, I was expecting a lot less.
Yeah,
I was too, and I think that was why my husband was crying. It's like I didn't expect it to look as sharp as it did. You know, we didn't see some of the, we didn't see Jason Isaac yet. We haven't seen a few of the characters. I'm mostly intrigued by her growing up on Vulcan. So the question is she Vulk, half Vulcan, or did she just grow up on Vulcan? I don't think she's. They did that with Spock. Spock's half and half. So I hope they don't do it with her character, but Sarek's involved, which is amazing.
I'll definitely tune in for the first episode, but I don't see myself paying CBS streaming to watch it.
That's them. You're right.
Unless, who knows, maybe it's the best thing I've ever seen, and then this is what actually propels me into a frenzy of binging every Star Trek ever.
I wonder what's going to happen with that. I'm sure you guys have talked about this on the podcast.
Yeah,
with CBS All Access.
We've been talking about it. We talk about it every few weeks, basically, since the announcement. We've kind of spoken at length here on the show about how we think yet another streaming service is a big mistake.
Unless it's cans. Mm-hmm. Unless it's cans.
But yeah, and then when the delay announcements came along, we were like, oh man, like what's going on? I do think that, I'll chime in, I'll agree with you guys. I think the trailer, it looks a lot better than I expected. I expected it to be much worse than how it appears. What will really, have to be seen is, does the story hold up? Because I mean, that's really the biggest thing about Star Trek is there's a lot of properties out there that you can get away with having a subpar story or a slightly subpar story. Star Trek is not one of those. The story has always driven Star Trek. It's the main allure. It's, it's what people are there for. So they really need to knock it out of the park, and it needs to be cohesive and strong. And I really do hope it is. So hopefully this is a sign that, they're just working really hard to make it as good as possible, and that's why it's delayed, not because it's going to be...
I hope so, man. I hope so.
I want it to be good.
Yeah.
Like, as a person who's not a Star Trek fan, I want it to be good so bad, because any good sci-fi is just great for the actual genre. So bring it on. I hope it's great.
And
I do too.
Sci-fi being a genre that really needs some strong entries, you know, at any given time, but especially right now, you know, we do live in a current media environment that is overwhelmed with, you know, the comic book stuff right now is huge. And, you know, this is a comic show predominantly, but we're really more of a fandom show. But honestly, like, we talk about comics at length and comic properties.
Right.
And obviously, I do love that stuff. But, like, even I can look at, you know, now we're talking about closer to a dozen than closer to half dozen different comic TV shows. And we're talking about, you know, a good half dozen comic films a year. It's very saturated. So I grew up on, you know, classic 80s and 90s sci-fi. My father always watched that stuff when I was growing up. I mean, I remember growing up watching Star Trek. He would watch it every night. He'd watch the TNG reruns. And, you know, as I grew up myself and, you know, transitioned into my teenage years, I started exploring all of it myself and, you know, watching the movies and the show, you know, and there's a lot there. It's a really great property that has a lot more story to tell. There's so many, you know, even when it's kind of a prequel thing like this, where there's, you know, there's so much history to go in and flesh out that if somebody does a great job, it can be a really, really rewarding experience. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, if they do it right, there's a lot of stuff to mine, you know, as far as stories that the other series have given them, like the whole Klingon War. We're actually going to see what happened with the Klingons, because it's talked about, you know, in other shows, but it's never, so it's going to be really, really interesting. And they'll be really interesting to see if there's any, you know, this is getting deeper Trek, I suppose, to see if there's going to be anything mentioned about, like, are you going to hear about a Kelvin ship, you know, since there's a different universes, there's a Prime universe and there's a Kelvin universe of the movies. And, you know, because you can tell some of the special effects are kind of from the Kelvin universe movies, but then they're doing a lot of old school stuff. I mean, the show takes place in the Prime universe as far as, like, you know, the tricorder and stuff like that. So I don't know, that's more deep cut stuff, but it's exciting. I'm so excited. And yes, I think we need more space shows. I mean, we got a lot of dystopia out there. We got a lot of comic book stuff out there. And I don't know if it's just that science fiction shows that take place in space are more expensive. I mean, the Expanse is out, but, you know.
Which I'm a huge fan of.
Oh, I'm in the middle of reading it right now. I'm in the middle.
I love the books.
Oh, it's so good. It's the first book I've bought in 5 years that I've actually read. So Leviathan
Waits, really great job.
Oh man, it's fantastic.
I might have to get into the books, because that the first season of the show was so good. And what I really loved about it is it had a lot of different, you know, influences clearly, but it really was what I was looking for in that classic sci-fi show. It dealt with sci-fi dilemma, it, you know, all that kind of stuff was great. And
including real science in it, which is another wonderful thing.
I love it.
And talk about a roller coaster ride too. You know, like, you start the season off and a couple episodes in, you think you know where everything's going. And by the end of it, you're like, what is this even? Like, what?
Yeah. So. And that first season, Paul, that first season is only half of the first book.
Oh, that makes me so happy to know. Oh, I haven't.
Yeah. So they didn't even do the full book. They just did half of the first book, and it's just like, wow, they are planning to be here for the long haul.
Oh, it's great, because my wife's waiting for me to finish the book before we can start season one. So I'll probably just get halfway through and sit down and actually watch it. Oh, that's great news.
All right, now how about the Orville? Did you guys you saw the trailers for that as well? Audrey, do you want to tell me what your take on it was?
I thought it was adorable. I'm curious if they can. It looked great. It's no Galaxy Quest funny, but it's funny. I'm curious if they can hold that out for a whole season, for a whole series of a show. Mm-hmm. You know, there's is it going to be funny for people that don't like that don't understand that genre, I think is a big thing. It looked like there are plenty of jokes in there that people that aren't fans of science fiction can still, you know, laugh at and stuff like that. I mean, that part in the trailer where he walks through that blob, that made me laugh out loud. That was pretty funny. Everything else I was chuckling through. But when he walked through that blob, that was pretty darn funny. But yeah, I'll watch it. I wasn't doing cartwheels over it. I know a lot of people think it's the best thing that they, which is great. I'm glad that they're excited about it. But it made me say, yeah, it made me put it on my list, but I wasn't going crazy about it. Because I will say it looks respectful too. I love, like Galaxy Quest was, you know, it's like, we're not making fun of it. We're making fun of, you know,
ourselves.
We're
making,
it's like, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
How about you, Phil?
I will watch it begrudgingly. I don't know. I'm on this. I'm either over Seth MacFarlane or this is going to reinvigorate my respect and love. Well, not respect, but my love for his content. No, I'll always respect him. He's done some great writing for many years, and his shows have, you know, were good, and then the fans brought him back. But I just, I'll watch it. I'm just, I'm kind of, I didn't care for any of the Ted films. I didn't bother with his Western. I just, we'll see.
I have to be honest, I didn't see any of them. There's nothing to make me like, I that's interesting. That's two people right there that are just kind of lukewarm on it. What did you think, Paul?
I thought it was, I feel the same way you do, Audrey, like where I feel like it, what will remain to be seen is whether the show can make those funnies work throughout an entire show. Because at first I thought it was a film and I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, I'm in. Like, I'll go see this. And then I was like, oh, it's a show. And then I'm like, oh, no. Like,
that's what I thought too.
Can you be funny for, you know, 10 to 24 hours? Because I don't know if you can. You know, so that's the real question is, and, I, you know, Victor Garber sitting there and being like, nobody wanted you for this. I lost it at that. I was like, how many times have we sat there with a Starfleet captain in an admiral's office, and it's always either they're building them up and getting them ready to send them out or whatever. And this, he's just like, nobody wants you, but I've got thousands of starships to man.
I gotta fill them and everything. And I thought that was really funny.
That's how I feel at my job.
So it's like the adventures of the 85th best Starfleet captain, you know, kind of thing, which I do think can be funny. It's just, I just thought the trailer was just, okay, that's interesting. It's on my list, but.
Hopefully that translates well onto the screen.
I was also really excited to see Adrienne Palicki
on the
show. She's great. I think she's got great comedic timing. So I'm really excited to see how that relationship plays out. I love the scene on the bridge while they're listening to them argue. And, you know, they're like, no, we're listening to this. This affects all of us. That was great. Because, you know, what I love the fact that it's going to poke a little bit of fun at how, like, prim and proper the Star Trek universe is. And how, like, everything's very orderly and, you know, everybody is usually following all the rules, and they're going to be like, not so much. I'm excited now.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be good. You know what I mean? I'm hopeful. I do think it was really humorous that they hit mere hours before the Discovery trailer did. So they really like, I feel like that's got to be some masterstroke corporate espionage there where they took a lot of wind out of.
Discovery. Yeah. Cause that's Fox, right? Not CBS. Correct. Am I correct in that? Yeah, you're right.
So we'll get a season before it gets canceled.
Yeah, well, they'll reorder the episodes, they'll cancel it halfway through the first season, and then we'll watch it on DVD like a year later.
Yeah.
I like how we know it's going to unfold already. Well, this is what's going to happen. Right. And you guys are probably exactly right.
They'll cancel it without finish airing the season, and those last three episodes was the crossover with Firefly, so we'll never get to see it.
No! Oh my god, that'd be fantastic.
Like, the last scene of the last episode is him opening up a box, and there's a brown coat in there, and then the end.
Oh, man.
Well, and it turns out it's not like a Starfleet. He's actually working for the Alliance.
Correct.
It's the funny part of the Alliance.
It's funny though too, because the scene in the shuttlecraft with the pilot really made me think of Wash. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh man, this is like,
oh yeah,
very much that spirit was captured in that moment. Yeah, so
Would you mean the part with the beer, you mean?
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh man, if they can capture, you know, that feeling and hold it, I wish them the best of luck. I mean, it's a tough network to be on, to say the least.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Like I said before, any good sci-fi is good for the genre.
Yeah, absolutely. So. I mean, even something like that that's more of a spoof, is as long as it's done with a level of authenticity and reverence, I think it'll be great.
Yeah. Well, hell, I mean, if this can get anywhere near Galaxy Quest type of funny, you know, I'd be so in. You know, it's just that Galaxy Quest was great as a 2-hour movie.
Yeah,
2 hours, and that's all. Yeah, so
do we know if these are 30 minutes or hour episodes?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Yeah,
we'll see how it all plays out. I would imagine, I feel like a show like that has to be hour long episodes, but I could be wrong. You know,
you would think you would think it would be.
I just feel like that setting, like any, even if you're spoofing sci-fi, you kind of need a few minutes to kind of get into the pace of each episode and all that kind of, you know, it doesn't lend itself to that quick 20-minute format.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be really disjointed and awkward.
So. Yeah, it'd be interesting.
All right. We're going to move on here. And, you know, so we've got a couple of real downers here. A number of sad things have also happened in the last week or so. You know, so it was kind of a somber moment for these last couple topics here. But the first one is news on the Justice League front. Zack Snyder is stepping down from helming the reshoots for Justice League. Now, I believe we reported here last week that Justice League was in for a bunch of reshoots. He announced in the past week here that he stepped down. Unfortunately, it's because of tragedy in his family. He and his wife are both stepping away from the film going forward. Their 20-year-old daughter, sadly committed suicide recently. And they were going to try, you know, Zach kind of came out and said, I want to kind of dispel some rumors before they get going, you know, because obviously there'd be a lot of, like, you know, just people theory crafting as to what went down if he steps away at such a pivotal time. He wanted to kind of dispel all that and let people know what was going on, but ultimately they both decided to take a step back and spend time with their family. And I just want to, on behalf of Charles and Chris and everybody here at GSTU, you know, we've bagged on Zach a lot, especially for the DC films. But at the end of the day, you know, it's one thing to critique the art, but it should not reflect poorly on the man and his family. So, you know, our condolences to Zach and his family. And, you know, it's a damn shame that something like this had to happen.
Oh, it's awful.
I also think it is. And, you know, I think it must have been very difficult for Zack Snyder to come forward. It was incredibly brave for him to make the statements that he did, from what I've read about it and what we covered on Geek Girl Authority about it. You know, being honest and admitting he went back to work after it happened, you know, because he thought that would be, you know, I can throw myself into that. And then realizing, hey, you know what? I'm human. I can't do this. My family needs me. I think they have 7 kids between them. They're a blended family. I think there's something like that.
They have a quite complex family. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, as a parent, I can't even imagine. So I applaud him for going and being with his family and taking that time, that whatever they need to heal. And Joss Whedon, who always comes across as a really good man, is somebody that I can see someone, a colleague, putting their trust in. You know, it's reshoots. The tone's already been set for the film. So Joss Whedon's going to, you know, he's a good guy. He's going to go in and he's going to do everything as Zack Snyder would want it to be done and respect everything he was trying to do with that movie.
Yeah, I neglected to mention that Joss Whedon's going to step in and helm the reshoots, and he's writing them too.
Didn't know he was writing them as well.
I had no idea.
Yeah, the article from Hollywood Reporter here says that Zack basically handed him essentially what sounds like full control and said, like, you know, do what you want
do
to
you.
Do, you know, because he trusts that he'll do it right.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure, you know, he and his wife, you know, you never know what's going on behind the scenes, and they may you know, Snyder and Whedon may be keeping in touch during this whole process.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, most definitely.
You know.
I'm sure there's some level of collaboration there. I mean, you know, it's really interesting because this comes on the heels of Justice League. Everybody's priming the pump to compare Justice League to Avengers. You know, Joss did Avengers, you know, so it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, all of this tragedy and sadness aside, it's going to be really interesting to see what comes about from a collaboration between these two.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised to hear it was Joss Whedon. I was really surprised, but
honestly, so
like
was I.
Yeah, but
I
like
mean,
I said,
everybody
he
was.
Seems like a good guy and that he'll respect what Zack Snyder wanted to do, you know?
Yeah. What were you trying to say there, Phil? You get.
Oh, no, everybody was surprised that Joss Whedon was taking over. But if anybody's going to do it, I mean, that's the man I want to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do we know how much is getting reshot of this movie?
It's reports put it at extensive.
So question is then, are we going to run into another situation where the trailer does not match the movie at all?
Mm.
And are we going to have another Rogue One or what was the other film? Suicide Squad on our hands.
I definitely don't think we're going to end up with a Suicide Squad. You know, say what you will about Zack Snyder, say what you will about his DC films. As disjointed as you could say that they were, and a lot of people did, he still had a vision and he still executed on it. And I feel like the big thing with Suicide Squad is that didn't seem to have a cohesive vision and then it failed to execute on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I really feel like with Joss at the helm, he's going to do what he can to make sure this gets done right. And so when they go into these reshoots, I imagine he's probably going to do some writing and work his magic and try to either make this as representative of Snyder's vision as possible, or try to shore up maybe some of its weaknesses and bring it to a more even keel for everyone. Which is why I'm really interested to see what comes of this collaboration, because it's, you know, it's very weird to let somebody else kind of, you know, take your baby and run with it. You know what I mean? Because
Zack Snyder has been so
connected to these films. Like it's, you know, it's not just a director picking up somebody else's project and doing it. This is, you know, he's been with these from basically since inception of this current universe for DC. And so Joss coming in, but Joss has that magic, man. You know, like he does a really good job with dialogue. A lot of times he does a really good job with, you know, highlighting themes that need to be brought to the surface. And I think maybe that's one of the things that BVS really lacked in, is that the core themes were kind of buried under a lot of details and distraction, and they weren't really being brought forward. And people were paying attention to weird stuff like Martha, you know, like, oh, both moms are named Martha, that kind of thing, because there wasn't anything else to emotionally attach to. So I think Joss will step in and find that emotional, you know, ley line and tap into it and bring it forward. And I think that could potentially save, you know, the DC cinematic universe, because this is a very do or die moment for the whole franchise.
Definitely.
There's
a number of films in the pipeline and everything that are attached to this that could suddenly lose a lot of funding if this film bombs. So
do you think that some of the reshoots would be because Wonder Woman has been testing so well that we need to get more Wonder Woman into this movie?
That could be possible. I would guess, if anything, if Wonder Woman is testing well right now, they're going to look at the tone set in that film and try to deliver on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, what is working about Wonder Woman? What is standing out to people? And then bring that out in, you know, because, I mean, the editing room floor is where a lot of movies make it or break it. You know what I mean? Like, you generally, you know, I don't work in the industry, but I am interested in it. And from what I understand, you shoot everything a million different ways. You try to get as much raw material as you possibly can, and then you sculpt it into the final product. And I feel like where the DC films have failed in the past is they've cut away the wrong pieces and kept some of the, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's really what I think. I think Suicide Squad probably had a lot more potential, but the edit just made it largely incomprehensible. I mean, to hear Jared Leto talk about how he filmed like over a full feature film's worth of scenes as a Joker, and we see him for a sum total of like 6 minutes in all of Suicide Squad says something, you know what I mean? So yeah, we'll see what comes of it though. I'm optimistic. I hope it works out, like both for as a fan of the DC characters and wanting to see that franchise do well, but also, you know, it'd probably be really nice for Snyder to see the film be a success and be able to know that he did the right thing by taking a step back and spending time with family.
Right.
Of course.
Because it would really suck to have a personal tragedy like that, have to step away from your project and then have it bomb despite trying to do the best thing for it. That would be really, really horrible. So,
and then everybody on the internet blaming the tragedy for the reason the movie sucked.
Mm-hmm.
So I want it to succeed so bad.
Yeah, I do want it to be good. I know Chris wants it to be good. Chris is a big DC fan. He said before, you know, he's largely a bigger DC fan than he is a Marvel fan. And Superman in particular is a character he really cares about. And, you know, he was probably our biggest detractor on the BVS panel episode, where he was the one that was like, no, you're all crazy for saying this is okay. This is horrible.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be something that we can all enjoy.
Yeah, together. As a Cyborg fan, I hope they fix the trailer.
Oh, man, they need to clean up that
boy.
CGI.
As a Cyborg fan, I'm a little nervous.
Yeah, that was some amateur hour stuff so far. Man. But, I mean, you know, early trailers are early trailers.
It was done in paint.
Other sad news, also last week, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, Temple of the Dog, and Audioslave fame also passed away suddenly. The coroner ruled it suicide, though his wife came out in the days afterwards and said that when she spoke to him last Wednesday night, that we're recording this on a week after his death, when she spoke to him, he sounded really out of it, and she suspects that his anti-anxiety meds might have played a part in it. So I'm sure that, you know, maybe we'll hear more about that in the future. But basically, she said that he sounded really optimistic when she talked to him, but a bit out of it. But they were planning vacation stuff, and he was really excited to be on the road. And so a real tragedy. 52 is far too young. Especially, again, as somebody who grew up in the 80s and 90s, grunge was a scene that was very important to my development as a young person. Really helped me kind of like understand the real world a little bit more than I did prior to being exposed to it. So this is kind of a tough blow to see one of my heroes pass.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's a punch in the gut.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's no other way to speak of it except like a punch in the gut, for sure. You know, and I believe that Chris Cornell, has, you know, one of the great rock voices in rock and roll history. There's hands down. And I share this with you. I went to see U2's doing their 30-year Joshua Tree tour right now, and I'm a big U2 fan. I saw them in 1987 for the Joshua Tree tour, so it was really fun to go 30 years later. It was at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, and so amazing rock show and everything. But before it even started, before they came stage, all the sound went out, and it cut off real quickly, and all of a sudden Black Hole Sun came on, and everybody, this is before they took stage or anything, everybody just got to their feet, and you know, this is a Rose Bowl, so you're talking like 80,000 people singing Black Hole Sun. There are people crying, you know, and everyone, and it actually didn't annoy me this time. Everyone, instead of lighters, had their phones up, but the sun was going down, and it was actually quite beautiful, I have to say. So that I thought was really lovely. But then during the show, Bono, before, my head is blanking. I love this song so much. I can't remember what song it was, but anyway, he said he dedicated a song to Chris Cornell, and I don't know if his voice was tired or not. But Bono's voice cracked and he was talking more than just saying, this is for Chris Cornell. He talked about Chris Cornell. So they must've known each other and talked about his lioness wife, Vicky. And then he named his kids. So I feel like Bono must've known that family, and he dedicated a song. And I'm telling you that people were just bawling. It was really a beautiful dedication, and it just reminds you exactly what you were saying, Paul, about how much he affected the lives of so many people, which in the only way that music can, which makes music so wonderful. And it's a really sad loss.
Yeah, yeah, it was particularly poignant for me because, you know, he's out of the Seattle grunge scene, and we've lost so many of those guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, we yes, lost, that's true.
We oh, well, yeah, grunge is just, they're falling left and right.
And yeah, it's running to stand still, which is a song about actually addiction and trying to get away. That was the U2 song. Sorry to interrupt. It was gonna.
No, yeah.
I told you I have OCD. I was gonna think about that until I got it.
yeah, you know. So yeah, this is just a shame. I read one article where somebody commented that like about 10 years ago, everybody started to get the feeling like all of our grunge legends were like out of the woods on this stuff. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
if they're okay now, you know, they'll be okay for a while. You know,
they've made it.
Well, that's the thing. Me and my wife were actually talking about Chris Cornell the day before he passed away. Cause we were talking about, you know, how bands from the '70s and sixties are now still touring and what bands of our generation are still going to be touring, you know, when we're in our 50s and 60s and 70s. And Stone Temple, Soundgarden was one of the bands that we talked about. And then the next morning I wake up and walk out and she's like, Chris Cornell died. I said, oh, what? No, stop. She's like, no.
Yeah.
Chris Cornell died. She's like, It's a shame, man.
It's
he had
it's
such
so
a beautiful voice, and it was on some of the songs on Super Unknown, he almost hits a Robert Plant level of power behind that voice, and it was just you know, they were always compared to, you know, Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin with the '90s, and with him at the front, it was believable because he had that stage presence and that power.
And that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm talking. He's one of the best voices in rock and roll history. He's up, I think, in like the top 25 as far as the power of his voice. I mean,
it's shame.
Such a sad loss. Yeah, it's a sad loss. I really feel for his family. You know, they're trying. You know, the press isn't really giving them any privacy, and the press is coming up with their own narrative, while the wife is trying to come up with her narrative of what actually happened. You know, and I just can't imagine. It's just so sad.
Yeah, you know, most reports that I saw, they spoke of his philanthropy. You know, he was a generous person. You know, he did struggle over the years with addiction and depression. I mean, that's been noted. But I mean, who doesn't? You know what I mean?
Like,
especially artistic people, you know, tend to be tortured souls in a way. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a real shame. You know, it's a voice of a generation, you know. I had hoped to, you know, I was speaking with one of my friends that I go to a lot of shows with, and we got to see, I'm reminded we got to see Pearl Jam in Madison Square Garden, you know, 6 years ago or so. I think it was when they were doing their 20th anniversary tour, if I recall correctly, of 10.
Oh, it's so good. I'm jealous and just hearing that.
They did Hunger Strike, and they had...
that's a good song, man.
Yeah, they had... who did they have... I'm trying to remember who...
was doing Band of Horses.
Yeah, Band of Horses was supporting them, and the lead singer of Band of Horses came out and did Cornell's part. And we were blown away, because he did a great job.
He could do it? Oh, because they're so kind of, like, kind of mild in their singing. Wow.
Yeah, no, he belted it, and we turned to each other, and we're like, you know, he almost out-Cornelled Cornell, but he did not. But we were just talking the other day, and, you know, we had both kind of always thought we would love to see Eddie and Chris do that song together someday, because my friend's a huge Pearl Jam fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is like one of those bucket list things that just suddenly got scratched off the list. Because it's just impossible.
Like, that's what we were talking about. Like, you know, you have these arena tour bands like Foreigner and Styx and all this, you know, whatever, going out on tour now. We were hoping that, you know, in a couple of years we would have Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and what's left of Stone Temple Pilots and all that, but...
Yeah. So we're going to move on. We have one other really sad... Well,
oh, let's bring it down just a little bit lower.
Roger Moore also passed away at the much more acceptable age of 89. You know, I have a rule here. I like to say if you're over 80 and you pass, it's a shame, but you had a good run.
I agree with you. I agree with you 100% when I'm talking to my contributors of my website, and I'm like, 90 years old, you know, that's pretty damn good.
Yeah, pretty good. Roger Moore of James Bond fame, though, you know, kind of controversial as James Bond, because not a lot of people like to think of Roger Moore as their Bond, but some people
He is my Bond. He is my Bond.
Oh, yeah.
He is my Bond. He is always will be my Bond. I am of an age where those were the movies that were coming out. I mean, they don't hold up. I just remember as a kid watching, we went to the movie theater and we went to see Moonraker and just being blown away. I saw it again a couple years ago, terrible movie. But, you know, when I was a kid, it was just awesome. It's still when it had that really cartoonish quality to it for some reason, which really appealed to me. And since he was my first, he's going to be my James Bond always.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so, as a kid, I loved his James Bond movies. The Spy Who Loved Me, and of course, of course, the younger Phil loved Octopussy so much. Like, just tell my dad that I want to watch more Octopussy, you know. But no, it's. I will go on record saying that I enjoyed Roger Moore.
Yeah, he just knew exactly what movie he was doing. You know, he knew what he was doing, and I loved it. I loved it so much. Rest in peace to him. I think he was a great addition,
you know,
to that franchise.
Yeah. Rest in peace to Zack Snyder's daughter, Chris Cornell, Roger Moore, you know, our condolences to the families. It's always sad to see prominent entertainers that we lose or watch their families go through hard times. So we send our love out to them. And, you know, thank you to Chris and Roger for, you know, the beautiful work that you gave us, you know. It's, luckily we live in an age where such performances can be, you know, memorialized forever.
That's
you know,
true.
We can always look back to them. So, and with that being said, we're going to wrap up the show for this week. I want to thank Phil and Audrey for joining me today.
Thank you.
It was super fun. Thanks for letting me, talk so much.
You can find us over at Facebook, Giant Size Team Up Network and Breaking the Panel. You can find us at GiantSizeTeamUp.com, and you can also find one other wonderful show and one you can find
agreed.
You can find Boos and Mazers at Giant Size Team Up as well, and you can find Botched if that is your cup of poo.
Yeah. It's a steaming cup, but
yeah. Well, it's fresh.
We make
fresh
it work.
It's fresh. That's the best kind of poop, is fresh.
It's agreed.
And if you have any comments about anything we talked about this week, or you just want to send us a shout out, feel free to email us at panelbreakers@gmail.com. I'm pretty sure I got that wrong. But we'll fix that. It'll be in the show notes.
I actually just got a text from Charles. He wants me to announce that next week, Chris, Charles, and Paul will not be on the panel. We will have Joe, Travis, and Dennis. So enjoy that shit show next week, everybody.
Yeah, it's not going to be. It's not going to be as good as what you just heard.
No,
just now.
Not even close.
This
was the best.
Yeah, totally.
I think Charles should just cancel Breaking the Panel after this episode because it's never going to be as good.
That's entirely possible.
Happened.
I mean. All right, we'll see you next week, folks.
Breaking the Panel is the flagship podcast on the Giant Size Team Up Network. You can support the show at patreon.com/breakingthepanel, and you'll find more of our amazing podcasts at giantsizeteamup.com.